I can't tell you. I just can't even describe to you the feelings I have about this service. Now, I've been talking to a lot of my friends on the phone and over email that have been talking for a long time about the real problems that we have had in the church. The problems that have caused us often to not even live like the church, not even resemble what we read about in the New Testament. And I got friends all over the country that are as jealous as anything today, because this day, in these three services, we may be more of the church than we've ever been before. All of my friends who are not believers have been invited and will be here today. Some of you here now. We have atheists and skeptics and seekers and non-believers coming. And some of our dear friends, as you know, here today, who are not believers, don't share the same belief we do. You say, what in the world does that have to do with the church? Somewhere along the line, we just must have stopped reading this book. Because when you really read what Jesus did, he absolutely loved being with people who were not like him. People wanted to kill him for it sometimes, but that's the way he lived. It's the way he lived and the way he loved, the way he embraced life. And even if some never received him, he went as far as to die for them anyway. Church, now, and when you read the book of Acts, you read the New Testament, how do they function? Well, everywhere you see them going, they're hanging out with people who don't believe anything like they believe, who don't believe in the God of the Judeo-Christian value, don't believe in any God, or who believe in idols. And that's who they spent time with. And they would gather and they would discuss and they would share, and they were unafraid to do so. They never could have dreamed of building the wall that the church is allowed to exist between us and those who don't believe what we believe. We have no apology for what we believe. We believe it passionately. We believe it intelligently. We believe it spiritually. We believe it emotionally. We believe it with the holism of who we are. We never apologize for that. We don't have to. There's no reason to. There is a spiritual longing in the heart of everyone. Lauren will tell you. She would tell you she has a spiritual side. I don't know that I understand that with her yet. But she would tell you that there's a spiritual side to her as well. We all have a sense in this world of spiritual longing. And for us to divide ourselves, or especially to make people who don't believe feel as if they're outsiders, unwelcome here, is the absolute opposite of what Jesus came to do. Now, we're in this series called The Second Mile Secret. You remember our theme verse, Matthew 5, verse 41? If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Right, we started all this off with Chick-fil-A and how a chicken restaurant lives more like the church than the church often does. All right, but I want you to think with me. We've done something a little different with this verse every week. I want you to think with me about who Jesus was talking about when he told us to go the second mile. Was he talking about the person that sits next to you in church that's easy for you to know? Was he talking about a person that goes to church across town that's very easy for you to relate to, speaks your language, is a part of your culture, knows all the things that you know about the Bible? No, remember who Jesus was talking about. A Roman soldier and a Jew. You could not have two more different people. Naturally, there was hatred, animosity, enmity between them. But Jesus said, knowing that it was law, that a Roman soldier could require a Jew to carry his bag a mile, not farther, a mile. There were markers, so you'd know. And they'd throw down that bag after a mile, angry, and go away. But Jesus said, no, when a Roman soldier forces you to go 1 mile, you go 2. Go willingly. Unleash the power of the unexpected, Jesus said, on people of all kinds. Now, I want you to think about how different the Roman soldier was. He was different in his race. He was different in his religion. He was different in his position in life. He was different in his lifestyle. Every possible difference was there. I guarantee you, far more difference between a Roman soldier and a Jew of that day than between Justin and Lauren and me. Far, far more difference. But Jesus said, when someone's as different as they can be from you in every single way, they share no bond with you that the world could possibly imagine, you create a bond. You create a bond. Jesus said, you do what I do. And if they want you to go 1 mile, then you go 2. And don't do it because you have to. Do it because my love is reaching out through you to people of all kinds everywhere. That's what the second mile secret means. Now today we're going to talk about second mile relevance. You know, this Roman soldier, that second mile that a Jew walked with him or a follower of Jesus walked with him, that may have been the second mile of thousands of miles for him. He would have journeyed from a faraway place, now in a strange country, with people he didn't know either, walking thousands of miles. And Jesus said, you know, you can probably go too. And go to with him, not for him, not because of how different he is from you and what he demands of you. No, with him. Walk with him. That's what relevance means. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We believe the Bible is truth. We believe that what Paul wrote meshes with what Jesus wrote. And Paul carries right into the same tradition and says, here's how you're to live. He said, this is how I live. Paul said, this is the way I do it. This is what you should do too. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 22, the middle of the verse is where we'll start. Here's what the Bible says about second mile relevance. Paul said, I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means, a lot of alls there, I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel that I might share in its blessings. That's not a very good translation, and we'll see why in a few moments. But how important is this for Christ followers? How important is this for Christ followers? I want you to think about that with me. This is what the Bible says we're to do. This is what Paul did. That we become all things to all men in any way that we possibly can to be relevant to the lives of real people and the real situations in which they live. How important is it? Well, I want you to see what he says immediately next in verse 24. Because it really doesn't seem to make sense. It's a powerful verse. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? You see what he's saying? He's saying what I've just told you is so important that if you don't live it, you lose in the life of being a Christ follower. You can't win in the life of being a Christ follower unless you're willing to go the second mile to be relevant to those who are different from you. And by the way, everybody in Corinth to whom he was writing would have recognized the language. It was the language of what was known as the Isthmian Games. Hard to say that. A lot easier to say Olympic Games. But the Isthmian Games, all right? Now, you can look it up on the internet and see a lot about the Isthmian Games. We know a lot about it. They were held every 2 or 3 years. Now, here's what would happen. If you won, if you were first place in the Isthmian Games, when you went back to your city, something amazing occurred. When you arrived back to your city, the leaders of the city would tear a hole in the wall. You wouldn't go in through the gate. They would tear a hole in the wall so that you could go into the city through a hole in the wall. And as you would go in, they would shout, with heroes like these, who needs walls? That's interesting. With heroes like these, who needs walls? We can tear a hole in our wall. We're not afraid because we've got this champion right here. God is saying to us, it's time to tear down walls. God's people have erected walls that Jesus never erected and never called us to be a part of. And it is time for God's people to tear down those walls. And if we do, if we will become those kind of people, we might even hear the whole world say, hey, with Christians like that, who needs walls? You know, who wouldn't want to get in on that? And we might see some follow us through that hole in the wall. Several years ago, a friend of mine called me up, Alvin Reed. And he said, you gotta read this book, John. I said, tell me about it. We're comparing books all the time. He said, it's called Righteous. It's by a woman named Lauren Sandler. And I said, I heard of it. Tell me about it. And he said, well, he said, she does a short but really good explanation of historical revival and the impact that it's had on our country. And he said, John, then she predicts a great youth movement to sweep across this country. In fact, let me show you the quote. We are poised before the next great awakening in American history. That's from Lauren's book, Righteous. And I'm going, man, that sounds great. I want to read this. I said, I'm surprised I've not heard of Lauren. And Alvin said, well, let me tell you the punchline. Lauren is a Jewish atheist. And for many, many, many times in speaking many places, I've said, isn't it ironic that there are some atheists who seem to believe in revival more than we do and talk about it more than we do. I read the book. I was moved to tears. I was angry at some of us, some of the ways we've lived as Christians. I was blessed. I was challenged. And I thought, you know, I got to at least take a shot at meeting this person. And so I emailed her, and we started emailing back and forth. Of course, Christy lives in New York. And so one day we sat down together and had coffee together. And I want to tell you, we just hit it off. And recently, Christy and I were in Lauren and Justin's home. Justin, Lauren's husband, is a Pulitzer Prize winning photographer. You've seen some of his pictures of 9/11. You'll see some other pictures in a few moments. And we were in their home. Now they've been in our home. We are really becoming very, very good friends. In fact, I would go as far as to say that God has placed a love in my heart for Justin and for Lauren. And would you join me right now in welcoming my friend, Lauren Sandler. Lauren? I told Lauren she better be prepared because she's going to get loved on today.
Already started.
Are you on?
Am I on?
She on? We on there? Okay. Okay. It's already started?
It's already started. The love has started.
Okay. Good.
I was warned.
You were warned and it's been appropriate.
But people keep asking me to bring their bags. Miles. I'm only kidding.
Second mile stuff, folks. All right. There you go. All right. Lauren, just give everybody your side of our friendship. I've told them about our friendship. What's it been like for you, coming from very different backgrounds and belief systems? What's it been like for you and for Justin developing this friendship?
It's been lovely. Obviously, I feel quite close to you and to Christy, and it's been an unusual relationship, I think, because it's not so often that people from such different belief systems, such different cultures, even within our one culture, really get together and connect. And one thing that I love is I feel like there are no walls. I feel like there's nothing that we can't talk about. All the things that you're not supposed to talk about over dinner, religion, politics, you name it, that's usually where we start, right?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted us to cover, actually. We may jump around from some of the things we talked about covering, but why do you think that is? I think most Christians, in fact, I've had some people say, I'm really excited about today, but what are you guys going to talk about? I mean, what's it going to be like? There's going to be an atheist up here. What's it going to be like? Why do you think that it's so little of this happens? Is it Christians' fault, non-believers' fault? What do you think the reason is that people don't talk the way we talk? We talk about, you're right, we talk about every single thing that there is to talk about, I think.
Well, I think it's everyone's fault. I think that we tend to be people who wall ourselves off quite easily, and that we're more comfortable around people who are like us, which, frankly, that's not a really great way to learn about the world or about other people or to really expand one's horizons and to develop new values and to forge new relationships. And I think that you and I are both people who really get interested in what other people believe and how other people live. And I think that you are excellent at finding the commonality there, which usually, if you actually sit down with someone, isn't that hard. And I think that, it can be a little complicated in this specific situation, because usually when we talk about how to get people to get along, of different faiths or different ideas, different politics, you name it, it's about finding the overlap, but a sense that you'll never really overlap. And of course, as an evangelical, the idea is to bring people along with you, to teach them what you know. And I think that often is where this gets tripped up. Because for non-believers, there's often this sense of they want to convert me. They, that the whole mentality, the only reason we'd be sitting down to dinner together is for you to get me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that becomes a sort of a difficult power balance. It's certainly difficult socially, and it puts people on guard a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when that can sort of be put to the side a little bit, when it's just two people being real with each other without sort of this perception of an agenda,
right,
that's where we can start to really connect.
Yeah. And, we've talked openly about that, no believer like me is going to apologize for saying, boy, I would want, the faith I have for you. And I think one of the things we've talked about a couple of times that's been helpful, and I think it'd be helpful to all of us in talking to non-believers, is that that's not in itself a relationship killer. Because as we care for people, it's natural to want things for them that are good. But it's not natural to be rude or to force things on people. And so if there's something that you experience that's good, if you and Justin take a wonderful trip, you might tell us, we went to this place, you've got to go. But you wouldn't be angry with us or try to force us to go. And I think that's a bridge we can build. You know, obviously, for me and for us, our relationship with Jesus is our life. But we had a kind of a poignant moment last night, I thought. I was talking to Donna about it after y'all left. In the book, Righteous, you wrote about a couple of guys named Ted. And one of the Teds, we'll get to another one in a minute. One of the Teds you built a relationship with, and it was a friend. But then all of a sudden, what exactly did he say to you kind of in the middle of a meal, I think? Or?
Yeah, it was funny. It's a friend that I made at a church out in Seattle, and I had spent the day with him. I think we both did, Justin and I did. And, you know, we had this really lovely day, really getting to know each other, and we went to his house for dinner and spent time with his kids and with his wife, and we had this lovely dinner, lovely conversation. And right after dinner, he sat down in his big easy chair, and he folded his hands, and he said, you know, we have a great rapport, but you don't believe what I believe, so frankly, this is as far as it goes. And I was really hurt and shocked by that. And I got where he was coming from, but I didn't think it was very effective. I mean, he clearly wasn't going to bring me closer to where he was living by building that wall. And we really weren't going to be able to get any further together, you know, as two people sharing a culture, sharing a country, sharing a lifetime with that mentality. And it was wounding. But I could also see where it was coming from. I mean, a lot of people grow up in communities where people outside their communities are seen as dangerous. I mean, I'm here as a non-believer from New York City. You'd probably think that I have the mark of the devil right on me. I don't think I do. But that said, I think that that's often how we relate to each other. Yeah, and that's heartbreaking.
That was, when I read your book, that was one of my teary-eyed moments. I felt so angry at that man. I felt a greater bond with you at that point than I did with him, even though he's a brother in Christ. I think that was so repugnant. And last night we were talking, you know, I made this point. I think it's important for all of us to understand this. How far can our relationships go with friends that don't know the Lord? I said, you know, let's think about Jesus. If what I believe is true, then Jesus died for you, Lauren. And he died for you, Justin. I said this last night. And I said, so I guess until I'm willing to go that far, I've not yet completely followed Jesus to the place where he's gone. And for a Christian to say, well, because you're not a believer, this is as far as it goes. We can't build our relationship further. That was shocking and angering to me, and it should be for all of us. Right? These are the kind of relationships that Jesus had and that we need to have with each other. Now, I want to talk about your journey just a little bit. In writing Righteous, tell us about how you wrote it. And as you do, by the way, let me show you some pictures. You're going to see some pictures Justin took. They're going to start running. And some people that you're going to see is very strange and unusual, you know, atheists and you know, skeptics. And people that, of course, you might not really want to have over, you know, for dinner to your house. You know, these are those people that we want to keep distant from us at arm's length. And actually, none of that's true. All of these pictures are of believers. These are of young believers that they met. Lauren, tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, we basically took a great road trip. And we were really setting out to sort of find the heart of young evangelical America. But what was interesting is while that took us to some churches, that also took us to a lot of places far outside the church. A lot of these pictures were taken at a rock festival, near a skate park, you name it. Because one thing that we really found is that at the heart of this great awakening is a real desire for authenticity. And there's something really anti-institutional about it. There's this sense amongst my generation and people who are younger than me that the institutions are flawed, that they're really divorced from how Jesus lived, and that in fact true Christianity, a lot of these people believe, is experienced outside the four walls of a church, is not something which just happens on a Sunday morning or on a Wednesday night, but that really happens out in the world. As Jesus lived, as Paul lived, and Paul is really, really important to this generation of Christians. And so that was really interesting, was to have these conversations about faith outside of a church.
Every week I tell our folks that never in Christianity or in the Scripture was the heart of what our faith is happening in four walls. This is worship and teaching and fellowship, but it is never meant to stay in these four walls. And what you're saying is you're predicting a great awakening. You've called it that. You're seeing that happening among young people. And they're expressing out of their heart that same thing, that we don't want a Christianity that's stuck behind four walls. Am I misquoting you in any way?
No, that's absolutely right. And certainly for some people, church does fulfill a lot. I mean, one thing that I would hear continuously is that, you know, the pressures of modern life, that, you know, that living in a world which is so bombarded by media, by information, by relativism, by, you know, growing up in families that may not be so nurturing, by not quite finding the love that they're looking for in the secular world, that communities like churches can, of course, be a huge part of that. And a lot of people feel like their small groups and churches can practically replace their families in some situations. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other people as well who would say, we don't need a church for that. We can build our own communities. We can live within our own culture in a way that isn't part of the institution. And that is a real change. But I think that if you look back in history a bit, it's not the first time that this has happened. Mm-hmm. And certainly not even the first time on American soil. I mean, obviously, the relationship has always been the most important thing. And you don't necessarily, so these people believe, need to go to church to feel that relationship.
And I think if our churches are going to have, many of them, if they're even going to survive, in a church like ours, if we're going to thrive, we have to tap into what's happening in a young generation and realize they're not just going to show up here. I mean, we're losing our kids when they graduate high school from our churches. They're not just going to show up here because you did or your parents did. They're only going to show up here if something is happening out there that is impacting their life. Agree with that?
Yes, but I would also say, I think that because of how some churches are losing young people, there's a real feeling of panic that suddenly kids aren't Christian anymore. And I do think that there are a lot of people who are living their faith outside the church in a way where it's harder to count them. Mm-hmm. But because of that, you can't just write them off. I mean, I think that there are many more young Christians in America than people are aware of because they're not finding them at youth group. They're finding them at rock shows or, you know, wherever kids congregate, and that becomes their church.
And that's, we really have to pay attention to that, folks. It has something to say about how we do student ministry today. Very important. Okay, I got to move quickly here. Tell us, what, so many things in the book, I just went, how does anybody become a follower of Jesus when we live this way? What are some of the things about evangelicalism that have kind of repelled you, have kind of pushed you away, that we ought to be aware of?
Well, I do want to say first, I'm not coming into your house to tell you what you're doing wrong.
No, I asked you to do it.
No, it's true. But, you know, I do think that it's a sort of question of agenda. And I think that, I mean, basically, I think you've got it all there in this book. I mean, you've got the example that you need. I think that the difficulty comes when the church as an institution and sometimes leaders within the church tend to pull people away from the model of Jesus, where it no longer is about the life which is being lived on earth. It's no longer about a humanitarian way of approaching things. It's no longer about building meaningful relationships outside of religion. A lot of people in this generation will tell you that, you know, Jesus is the answer, but religion can be the problem. That, you know, that the notion of something which is too doctrinal, too self-isolating, too much about, you know, the rules and the walls, all of these different things can push people out. And I think that that's true. And I think that where we find commonality and where we connect and build a relationship that may open up in lots of different ways is when it's not about religion per se. It can be about faith. It can be about love, and it can certainly be about how Jesus lived. I mean, there's no better example. In my opinion. But when it becomes about this sort of us and them mentality, then I think we're in dangerous ground.
I just think this is extraordinarily cool. You've heard, how many times have you heard me tell you it's not about religion? We don't even like religion. We don't believe in religion. It's about relationship, and you're hearing the same thing from a non-believer. And that's very, very interesting.
Well, it's a lot easier for me to say.
Yeah. And you know, something that you and Justin said at dinner the other night, I was so cool. You said basically that Jesus impresses you, and you often wonder why more Christians don't talk about how cool Jesus is. Think about that. All the times you've thought, oh, I could never talk to an atheist or someone that doesn't believe. You know, here are two atheists who are my friends and who are telling you that Jesus is cool to them, and they don't get why we don't talk more about Jesus. So, okay, by the way, I got to talk about the other Ted just briefly. I've told them this, just confirmed this actually happened, because it's just so shocking that this church in Idaho, where there was a youth revival, and they brought drugs and flushed them down the toilet, and then a man, a grouchy man, stood up in the church and shouted. You want to tell him what he said?
Well, it was even more than that. A friend of ours, Ted, who's he's a skate pastor. He travels around the country, sleeping on church floors. That's pretty much the only time he goes into church anymore, is when they're putting him up in the basement. We stayed with him there. He was leading a revival in a church in Idaho where there was a lot of gang activity. And against all odds, I don't know how he did it, though you may have some ideas, he was able to really bring a lot of the kids from these gangs into church, and he got them together in the bathroom, and they started flushing their drugs down the toilet, which I thought was a pretty big deal. And he was speaking about this in church the next Sunday, and people got up in the church and said, "You're going to screw up our plumbing system. We can't have you doing this in church anymore." They were more concerned about their plumbing system. So he left church, and he took a show on the road, and he's never been back since. And to me, what Ted is doing really speaks to what I think is done in this book, is really sort of this notion that, okay, if really reaching people isn't going to work within the institution, we're going to find our own ways to make it happen, and he's really done that.
All right. That's who we cannot be. Now, what about Christians or churches have drawn you? I'm going to read in a section from your book. You've been very vulnerable and about you know, your experiences. What has drawn you? What's been good about your experience with Christians?
Well, I've met a ton of people who I've really connected with and who I think really communicate in love, and who, you know, are incredibly generous and who live their lives in a way which is really admirable. A lot of people who I think like humanitarians more than a lot of secularists do. And I continuously think, you know, I think of the work that you did at the World Trade Center after 9/11. I think of the response around Hurricane Katrina. I think about what's going on in Africa right now. And the fact is that the first people on the scene tend to be Christians, that the missional attitude is what brings people around the world to do the work with the neediest people. And that to me is something which is always moving. I also think that you don't just need calamity to have that sort of attitude. And that when I see communities where people are reaching out to people who need it the most, that really speaks to me. And there are also smaller ways to do that. There are ways to just communicate in relationship that I find really moving. And I also find the intentional buildings of communities that keep people close, like families. That's incredible. There's nothing else like that that we have. In this country, at least. And so there's a lot that I long for that I see in the church that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm a believer or a non-believer. It's just an aspect of how people tend to live when I think they're living the best that they can within a church community, which is really unlike anything else.
Okay. Well, there's so much to cover. Let's see. I think we've got to close it up here. So, what have we missed? Anything that you want to say you think would be helpful for folks to hear?
I think we just covered a lot.
Yeah, we
and I want you to have the last word here.
Yeah, I'm going to have the last word. But we talked the other night for 4 hours, so that gives you an idea of how we communicate together. But, Lauren, I tell you, I hope this will be the first of many times that you're here. And obviously, we would all love to see you come to faith in Jesus. But I think I can make this commitment to you. Whether that ever happens to you or not, you'll have folks here that will treat you like family. We are committed not to build those walls. In fact, to tear a hole in them and walk through them with people. That's what it means for us to win as followers of Jesus. That's what the second mile looks like. And we want to thank you for helping us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Thank Lauren Whitman.
Thank you.
You bet.
I want to read you a quote from Lauren's book. It's another one of these teary moments for me. I hope hope by the third service it'll be easier for me to read it now. And a part of it is my heart that reaches out to people who have not found faith. I never can ever forget the moment when what Lauren kind of was close to here happened in my life. And this was precious to me. She was at a conference in Colorado Springs, and this is what she wrote. "Well, the worship band is playing. Suddenly I feel a brokenness inside, and I can't stop crying. Despite my guardedness and my skepticism, was this to be the moment when I am born again? Has my long trip here not only been my own journalistic investigation, but a path God has set to bring me to Him?" And then she says this, "Are you there, God? It's me, Lauren." If you've not learned how to love people who are asking those questions, you're just beginning the very journey of what it means to follow Jesus at all. To love people who would say, it's me, God, Lauren, are you there? This is what I wrote. This is the first time I've read to you from my new book. I've read to Celebrate Recovery, but this is the first time I've read to the entire body. "I've read those words many times," Lauren wrote, "over and over. I love the vulnerability Lauren showed in writing this, in shining the light on the inside of her heart, and letting her readers see her struggle, her longing, yet ultimately not her conversion. She stepped back from that precipice, not ready to take the faith plunge that belief would have required. And though I don't base my friendships on whether someone is a Christian or ever becomes one, I can't help but want this for her. I want her to know that all of her intellect, her wonderful gift of writing, her graciousness, her family," and you gotta see baby Dahlia, by the way, in our preschool, "all of her life means something forever. And I want her to know the adventure of life with Jesus in the here and now. Are you there, God? It's me, Lauren." He is, Lauren. He really is. And for any of you who are reading this and as a seeker, haven't you felt that same pull on your spirit? And I say that to any of you who are seekers. Maybe you even felt it as you read Lauren's words. I pray that you'll take the risk of faith. Not blind faith, but reasoned, rational faith, yet faith nonetheless. Faith always requires a step into what looks from where we stand like darkness. I hope you'll take that step, that risk, and believe, and step into what you will find is really the light. And forgive us, Christians. Forgive me for so often making it so hard for you to do so. Folks, how do we become relevant to the lives of non-believers? How do we become relevant to the lives of people? How do you form friendships with people like Lauren and Justin? Real friendships, not based on whether they're Christians or not. You don't ever have to apologize for wanting them to be. But not based on that. How do you form those friendships? I want to tell you a few things as we close. Number one, get rid of our arrogance. Get rid of our arrogance. I want to give you a better translation of verse 23. Sometimes translators from the Greek or the Hebrew paraphrase things more because they're just not quite sure if the absolute word-for-word translation makes sense. This one does. Verse 23 in the NIV says, "I do all this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessings." Listen to, this is the Avant translation, and I humbly want to say I think it's better. "I do all this through the good news so that I can be a partner in good news with those I share it with. I do all this through the good news." All right. Paul says, everything I'm doing as I communicate, as I love, as I share, I do through good news. I want to be good news so that I can be a partner in good news with those I'm sharing with. We got to get rid of our arrogance, folks. It has hindered the church for way, way too long and has pushed people away from us who should be our friends. Many who might come to faith in Jesus, but they won't as long as they see us as arrogant. As in essence saying, we're here because we have all the answers and we're here to straighten you out. And if you just listen to all of our answers, then everything will be okay for you. That has nothing to do with biblical evangelism. The word evangelism means to share and to be good news to people. Does that sound like good news to you? Now listen, we call people that don't know Christ lost. I write in my book a chapter that says that's not really such a bad thing. It's not a terrible word. Lost is not like being, you know, ugly. You know, you can do something about being lost. You know, if I'm lost, I can be found. But I think we've often used that word with arrogance. You know, you're over there and I'm over here. And if you'll come and listen to me, I'll straighten you out. It's not the way Jesus functioned. Let me tell you something. I did a study this week of the word lost. Even a deeper study than I'd done when I wrote the book. I wish I'd done this beforehand. Do you know, this is shocking. Do you know that fully 50% of the time when the Bible uses the word lost, it's referring to us? Let me give you an example. Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 6. My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray and caused them to roam on the mountains. They wandered over mountain and hill and forgot their own resting place. My book's called If God Were Real. Listen, if I believe God is real and live like He's not, I am wandering around lost. I'm lost from the very one I say I believe in. Let me ask you a question. Who needs Jesus more today, me or Lauren? Me or Justin? We all need Him. Our belief is that I need grace for this day as much as Justin or Lauren could need grace to say, Lord, we choose to believe in You. I need grace just as much. Listen, my life without Him would be an absolute disastrous mess, and sometimes with Him it is. I need grace. You need grace. Get rid of our arrogance. Treat people like they're valuable, like they're somebody that even if they never ever believe what we believe, Jesus hung on a cross and wept naked, stripped of the skin on His body, beaten and bruised and nailed there, and said, Father, forgive them. They don't understand. They don't understand what they do. And for us to push people away and keep them at arm's length, my goodness, they might influence our children. How foreign to Jesus could that possibly be? Get rid of our arrogance and then be unexpected good news to everyone. Be unexpected good news to everyone. I wish I had time. I'm not going to have time to go to Luke 15, the whole chapter. Just read Luke 15. Would you just do me a favor and read Luke 15 and look at what Jesus said? It says that the tax collectors and sinners, and it puts it in quotation mark, those that the religious people viewed as sinners came together and Jesus hanging out with them. And they said, look at that man. Look at him. He must be a sinner himself because he hangs out with people like that. And Jesus gave us a story of how much He loves people. He said, you know, if I got 99 sheep that are just safe and doing fine, but I got one that's not, my greatest joy is going to be going and finding that one. Jesus loved being with people who weren't like Him. And He beckons to us and says, come on. Come on and follow me. You say you're a Christian, a Christian, a follower of mine? Then come with me. Because I am going outside of these walls where people live who are not like you. Get rid of your arrogance. Be unexpected good news. But go the second mile. Be good news to everyone. And always tell people why. You heard Lauren? Don't be afraid to talk about Jesus. Don't be rude. Don't act stupid. Don't be a know-it-all. But just share what means something to you, what He's done for you. Tell why. Tell why your life is different. I'll tell you why right now for me. Because as a young man searching for truth, one day somebody told me what an atheist told you, that it wasn't about religion. It wasn't even about a church. That it was about Jesus and a relationship. And I thought about it. And as a young man with not a whole lot of experience, I chose by faith to accept it. After that, I began to wonder, is this intellectually sound? Do I have to check my brain at the door? Can I go ahead and go to college and even get a doctorate and actually believe this stuff? Is it silly to believe this? And I want to tell you, over the years, Jesus has saved me intellectually. He has saved me emotionally. He has saved me philosophically. He has saved me spiritually. He's saved me in every way that I could ever be saved. And I love Him so deeply and desperately for that, that He found me where I was. You know what He did for me? I can't illustrate it any better than what He did, what happened to me in New York when I was there a week ago. I had this great trip. We had this wonderful time. Everything was accomplished I wanted to accomplish. All of my meetings. And Monday night, this fabulous time with Justin and Lauren. And then all through Tuesday and Tuesday night, I'm about to go to bed, you know. And I'm just going to get on the plane, come home, be with you for our destiny service Wednesday. And I got sick. And I mean sick like I have never, ever been sick. And I said, I got to go to the pharmacy. It was pouring snow and I threw on a coat and I thought it's only two blocks. I can walk down 8th Street. I can make it and get some Pepto-Bismol. It's an all-night pharmacy. And as I turned on the corner of 8th Street, I couldn't believe it. I remember right now thinking, oh no, this can't be happening. I could feel myself beginning to stumble like this. And the next thing I knew, I opened my eyes and I didn't know where I was. And I looked at my arm and I didn't understand because there was snow on my arm. And there was vomit on the wall. I had passed out on the street of New York, fallen against a wall, vomiting, lying there, my own vomit, covered in snow. And I watched and people were walking by. I had joined the list of these. I had joined the ranks of the homeless and nobody cared. And I stood up and stumbled on my way to the pharmacy and tears were coming to my eyes. And I said, Lord, you found me when I was spiritually just like this. And I know that I know that I know that it's real. I know it with my mind. I know it with my heart. I know it with my intellect. I know it with my spirit. You found me just like this. But Lord, there are people all over this world for whom nobody cares. And most of all, the people that you died for, Jesus, your own, have not cared either. And I laid in a bed 24 hours, thrown up. But I kept coming back to that moment of remembering what it's like. They have nobody that really cares. We are never, never going to be that people. Not for the up and out or the down and out. Not for the person across town or for our friend in New York. We're never going to be that way. Never again. Because that's not what Jesus' followers do. Here's the bottom line of joining Jesus in his world. Do we just want people we disagree with to be beaten, to lose? Do we want to win an argument? Or are we for people? Because I promise you, Jesus is for people. Are we for people? And if we are, can you imagine what would happen if we turned loose second mile relevance and second mile creativity? And if we just started loving people in practical ways? What if everywhere you went, everywhere you go, you just said, Jesus, help me love people today. Show me how. Show me something creative. Show me how to do something that nobody else could do, but I can do it because of the place you have put me in, like a head coach of a high school football team named Chris Hogan. You want to see second mile relevance to people different from you? You may have heard about this. Oddest football game ever played, maybe. It happened last fall. Grapevine High School football field. You'll see their football team coming up here. They played Gainesville State School. This is an evangelical school you're looking at. And they played a football game against an 0-9 football team. And you'll see a scene from the game coming up here, I think. I think we got one before that or after that. There we go. We got a scene from the game. And let me tell you what was unusual about this game. Gainesville State School was the visiting team, and when they arrived, they really couldn't understand because there was a banner for their players to crash through, and it said, Go Tornadoes. That was their mascot. The other team had created a banner, and there were parents lined up for 40 yards for them to run through that banner. They didn't understand why there were 200 fans in their stadium from the other side. They didn't have any fans of their own, you see. They really couldn't understand why the team was shouting, defense, 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 when their team had the ball. And even though they lost 33-14, they gave their coach a Gatorade bath at the end. They'd never done that before. Why did all that happen? Because you see, as soon as the game was over, the guards came and put the handcuffs back on and took these students back to the bus, these young people, back to the Gainesville State School. They were juvenile prisoners. All their games were away games. And it started when Faith's head coach Chris Hogan wanted to do something for the Gainesville kids. Many of them convictions for drugs, assault, and robbery. Their families had disowned them playing in 7-year-old equipment. So Hogan sent an email and said, what if half our fans, for one night only, cheered for the other team? What if we did just that? He said, here's the message I want you to send. You are just as valuable as any person on planet Earth. One of their linemen said, I thought maybe they were confused. They started yelling defense when their team had the ball. Why are they cheering for us? He said, we can tell people are a little afraid when we come to the games. We can see it in their eyes. But these people, they were yelling for us by our names. They played the best they played. They scored twice. They hadn't scored but once all season. And at the end of the game, you'll see a picture right here of their quarterback named Isaiah. And Isaiah asked to speak to both teams. There he is with his helmet in the air. And this is what he said. We had no idea what the kid was going to say, the coach said. But Isaiah said, Lord, I don't know how this happened, so I don't know how to say thank you. But I never would have known there were so many people in the world that cared about us. And as they walked to the bus, the players gave them a bag with hamburgers and fries and sodas and candy and a Bible and a letter from each faith player a letter to one of the players, and the coach of the state school grabbed the Coach Hogan by the shoulders and said, "You'll never know what your people did for these kids tonight. You'll never, ever know." And as the bus pulled away, all the Gainesville players crammed to one side, pressed their hands to the window, staring at these people they'd never met before, watching their waves and smiles disappearing into the night. This is not a Christian journal. This is ESPN. Written right before Christmas, it says, "Anyway, with the economy 6 feet under and Christmas running on about 3.5 reindeer, it's nice to know that one of the presents you can give is still absolutely free." Now, what if we started to live like that? That second mile relevance, that's the way Jesus lived, that's the way he loved. Listen, that's who he made you to be. So let's go be church. Jesus, I pray right now that you would create in us a hunger for second mile relevance. Lord, to follow you, to stop talking about it and putting up walls and follow you to people, all people, and love like you love and create. Lord, how much fun is it going to be when things like this start happening in our own community? Send us out now, Lord, to do it in the name of Jesus. We ask it. Amen. Now, we're running a little late today, but that's okay. This is a special day. Listen, if you're our guest, where it says reception, you join me right out there. We've got a gift for you. If you've got questions, spiritual questions, we're not going to pressure you. If you're one of my friends or a skeptic or an atheist, but you just want to talk, you know, we can talk with you just like Lauren and I talk and Justin and I talk. If you want to talk, come right out there. If you know, I'm ready for a relationship with Jesus, we can help you with that too. If you just need a friend, come on out. Now listen, very carefully as I walk out, these are two very huge, huge, important announcements. We do not have Destiny here Wednesday night. All right, everybody hear this. Destiny is moved to Thursday. And we have one of the great worship leaders in the world who will be here. You remember what Revelation song that we do here? No sweeter name. She wrote these songs. And Carrie Jobe with her band will be leading us in a night of worship. Destiny will be worship this week. All worship with a segment of prayer at the end for next Sunday. Right? I expect this place is going to overflow. Other churches are coming. You need to get here at 6:30, no later. It starts at 6:30. You better come early. We're moving from 6 to 6:30. Don't miss it. 6:30. Thursday night. Say Thursday night. Thursday night. Don't forget and be here Thursday. Next Sunday, if there's any Sunday this year that you come, come next Sunday and bring a friend. It's Second Mile Celebration. Read all about it in here. It's going to be an amazing, amazing day. You be here for the Second Mile Celebration next week. But first of all, for worship with Carrie Jobe, and ladies, don't forget, 4 o'clock, P3 with Lauren and Christine and my wife Donna. Listen, I love you guys. It is so much fun to be church with you. Let's get after it and be relevant to everybody on the second mile. God bless you.